the reality is there is no one single magic bullet that can do this. There's no single fuel that can do the trick for shipping. 10 years from now, we may learn that this one was better than the other one, but I think the only way to avoid the complexity that we have today would be to do nothing. And that's not really an option in our view. And I think the industry's perception also, we want to do something here and now. And then we just have to embrace this technology and deal with it. And we can.
Welcome to Leaders Unplugged, real talk with the impactful, presented by IMD. I'm David Bach, your host. And today we're diving into one of the toughest, most important questions in business. How do you decarbonize an industry with a massive carbon footprint? That industry is global shipping, and at the center of it all is Maersk, one of the world's biggest shipping companies. Maersk needs as much oil each year as the entire planet makes in a day, and it produces more CO2 than its home country of Denmark. Our guests are Morten Bo Christensen, who leads Maersk's decarbonization team, and Bo Serup Simonsen, the CEO of an independent center called the Maersk McKinney Møller Center for Zero Carbon Shipping. Together with other leading companies, including some of Maersk's fiercest competitors, they're doing something extraordinary, building an ecosystem to rally an entire industry. They're placing bets on multiple alternative fuels, knowing that many and perhaps most will ultimately not pan out. Several of these fuels require a complete redesign of supply chains. The magnitude and complexity of the challenges is such that many would have chosen inaction. Why join forces with competitors? Why accept so much uncertainty and risk? But Maersk decided to move ahead, to not be paralyzed. And in the process, its leaders learned some really interesting lessons about collaboration and how to get the balance of competition and collaboration right. I learned a lot from our guests, and I'm sure you will too. Here are Morten Bo Christensen and Bo Serup Simonsen. Morten and Bo, thank you so much for joining this conversation on Leaders Unplugged about decarbonization in the shipping industry. There are a lot of things that the two of you have in common. You went to the same school. You even told me you have the same watch, and you're working both on decarbonization in the shipping industry, but you do it in complementary ways, in different ways. Morten, can you explain to folks Maersk's decarbonization strategy? What are you doing and why are you doing it?
So shipping emits somewhere between 2 and 3% of all global emissions. So really our sector is a heavy emitter. The company I represent, which is A.P. Moller Maersk, we actually emit more Scope 1 emissions than the country we are headquartered in, which is Denmark. And furthermore, shipping is not part of the Paris Agreement. Shipping and aviation emissions comes on top of the global accounts. So when we looked at this a while back and we started realizing that the climate crisis is for real, and we're part of the problem, we looked around and also at that time, the International Maritime Organization, which is the UN body that regulates shipping. Back then, the IMO had a rather unambitious strategy for the sector. So we acknowledged we have a problem. We acknowledged we are part of the problem. And we had a desire to then also be part of the solution. And we felt that we could be part of the solution. And it started back in 2018, where we had a target to at least comply with the Paris Agreement, so a net zero in 2050, a target. And then we started working on what are the solutions, how might you do this? Well, it's basically two elements. The one is efficiency, and the other is alternative fuels. And most people talk about the new fuels because it's exciting, it's technology, you know. But the most sustainable fuel is really the fuel you don't burn. It's also the one that has the best business case. So efficiencies are really important, but actually sometimes a bit overlooked in the conversation. But that's obviously a big part of it. But then also simply translating our fleet to burn something different from the conventional bunker fuel oil that the shipping industry has used for 400 years. We realized that there are different pathways. We decided to not sit and wait to see which one would be better, but just to get going. So we went with the one that we felt were the most scalable and most mature at that time, which was methanol dual-fueled vessels. And right now we have 14 of those on the waters and another 32 coming in both our own new buildings and chartered vessels. And furthermore, we went out and tried to find the fuels because the fuel market at that point in time was simply non-existent. So we are now in execution mode and we are also expanding our portfolio of technologies because it's clear there are other candidates than methanol. We now also look into methane, which is kind of the gas version of methanol, you can say. And later, we also expect something like ammonia can be a candidate. So there's a lot of opportunities in our industry to solve the problem. The challenge really is the cost challenge. But that is sort of the five-minute version of of the plan.
That's terrific. And, you know, so many companies are often criticized for having lofty ambition, but perhaps not putting money where their mouth is or making the necessary investments. And for you, this isn't abstract theory. You have the vessels in the water already after just a few years, and you have ordered more. And if I understood you correctly, it wasn't because the Paris Accord required you to do this. It was precisely the omission of the industry from the Paris Accord that motivated you to take action. Can you just say a little bit more about this? You mentioned the impact of the industry as a whole, but it's quite different from other organizations who sometimes feel that if they're not being required to do something, they don't. And for you, it was the absence of inclusion, if you will, that motivated such decisive action.
Well, I actually think that there are many companies who feel that it is actually possible to do good business and also do it in a good way. Certainly our company, we are a very old company, and our majority owner has this basic concept of, the Danish word is nyttig virksomhed. It means basically useful deeds, right? So that you need to do good business, of course, because you are a business, but also you need to have positive impact on society. So I do think there's an element of feeling an obligation for conducting our business in a responsible manner. And I don't think we are alone. I think many, many companies have that. There are also many that doesn't. But I do think more and more companies actually take responsibility for more than only delivering returns to their shareholders. But I think in our company, because of the heritage and so on, it has been in the DNA. And it's not that we are an NGO or a charity, because we are not, we are business. But we do actually think that these things can go hand in hand. And for this particular matter, yes, we were willing to accept more risk than we normally did. But we also felt it was such an important topic that that's what it took.
Terrific. You said you're a business, you're not a nonprofit. And, you know, Bo, you are in the sort of think tank and nonprofit world. You lead the Center for Zero Carbon Shipping. Can you describe the work that happens at the center? How does it complement what Maersk is doing, but also how is it different from the work that Morten just described?
Thank you very much. And I think Morten's introduction here is a very good example of why the center exists. Because if you look back to, let's say, 2018, the state of the union was that there were companies putting forward aspirations and ambitions and also plans. But if you looked at it in an industry-wide perspective, it was also clear that those companies alone would not make it a scalable transition for the entire industry. And so in order for this to become a robust and scalable transition for the entire industry, to be in sync with the needs of the rest of the society, our center was established to help the leaders come together to strategize and to show the way forward with the idea that this should turn into standards and concepts and eventually regulations that would drive the entire industry along. So you can say, in a way, turning industry best practices to, or industry leadership from a few companies to industry practices across the entire industry. So back in 2020, our center was founded by the A.P. Møller Foundation with a very generous grant and an idea to create a place, a platform for global collaboration where leaders from industry and also public sector could come together to create visions and pathways of how our industry should develop, to share ideas about what would be needed in order to make this transition scalable on an industry-wide basis, which of course implies developing some concepts for what does the future look like. So Morten was talking about the future fuels, for example. And at that time, 4 or 5 years ago, there was a lot of uncertainty about what would the technical solutions look like. So even just starting to develop some of the basic ship design, some of the basic procedures for how you would store the fuel and handle the fuel and how it would be converted into propulsion on the ships, were some of the basic first questions that we started to work with. But overall, the basic idea was to get confidence in the transition pathways, to get an understanding, a common understanding, that it is possible to decarbonize shipping, which used to be called a hard-to-abate sector, with the notion that we don't need to decarbonize anytime soon. So get an understanding that it is actually possible to decarbonize shipping, and then start to work on some of the concepts and standards that would be needed in order for this to become a scalable transition. So that was the basic idea. That was the vision with which the A.P. Møller Foundation created us 5 years ago. And that has been the guiding principle ever since. So with this initial vision, a lot of companies signed up to say, okay, we would like to be part of that. That makes sense for us because there's so much we don't know out there and we can't drive the whole supply chain ourselves. We can't develop those frameworks and standards ourselves. We need a club. We need a coalition to be part of where we can not only talk about the visions and the aspirations, but actually get down to the concrete concepts and standards that will be needed in order for us to take this into the commercialization phase and actually implement it in our commercial business. So with that vision and those guidelines, we onboarded a large number of partners, and we started with 7 founding partners, energy companies, shipping companies, and cargo owners. And then we expanded that first to 24 strategic partners, and then to knowledge partners, to academic partners, and also to the wider community. So now we have more than 100 organizations working with us on this mission.
That's amazing. And you know, one of the things that I think is striking when you look at your list of partners and members, of course, you have shipbuilders and engine manufacturers and customers, but you also have competitors to Maersk, right? So, you know, this is open to folks from across the industry. Is that correct, Bo?
That is absolutely correct. And when we started the center, I think we were all a little concerned whether this would work out in practice, whether we could actually put competitors side by side, both to strategize on the top level, but also to work on the details on the expert level. But it has turned out that it generally works very well. Of course, there are boundary conditions of compliance and competition law and so on, data sharing. There's a lot of practicalities that you need to be aware of, and there's a cultural component too that you need to be aware of. But the driving force in this is that our partners see a need for common standards and common frameworks to work into. So, I mean, one obvious example here is on the fuel standards, the way we do the life cycle assessment of the fuel production and usage pathway. That needs to be a common global standard in order that we're not fooling ourselves. So that is an area where we've put together a very strong team that works also with academia and also into the standard setting and regulatory space in order to create standards that are practical and can be implemented, but at the same time are accurate enough that we're not fooling ourselves by jumping to new fuels that are doing actually more harm than good in implementation. I can mention another example where we worked on the energy efficiency standards that Morten was also alluding to, and we received data from our partners to something around 15% of the global emissions. So it was like 200,000 voyages from commercial ships. We put all that data together, and based on that, we were able to develop a new data standard that we submitted to the IMO to say, if you want to be better in the future in being able to regulate for energy efficiency, this is the data standard that you need to put in place. And it was actually agreed in the IMO that we'll go forward with this standard. So I think that was also a very nice example of where competitors came together, they submitted their operational data, and we worked out some standards that will then come back to the industry to say, this is how you will need to report in the future, and this is actually going to be used for regulating you in the future.
Yeah. So you have greater impact when you do it together, when you approach regulators as one industry. And Morten, I can certainly appreciate the sort of benefits of standardization on a journey like this. But inevitably, you're sharing information with competitors. You're probably helping them innovate faster. You spoke earlier about an important part of this being energy efficiency. So by inviting your competitors to the table, you're probably even helping them save money. Talk a little bit, if you would, about the sort of thinking behind this ecosystem approach and the sharing and opening up this space for this kind of collaboration.
Yeah, I think Bo covered a lot of the aspects why this is the right way to go. But I think if you just take one step back and see what we are trying to achieve here, it's a complete transformation of the entire energy system of a massively huge industry. I mean, it's simply no one company can do that by themselves. The problem we are trying to solve here is, I think, also kind of beyond any one company's interests or sort of competitive domain. I mean, we compete like crazy in our industry. It's a very competitive industry, and that's how it will always be. I think there's a recognition across the industry, this is not an area to compete, this is an area to collaborate. And yes, I hope some of our competitors can learn something from us, from what we have done. I certainly want to learn from them what they have done, because I just think it's in everyone's best interest here. And it does not influence competitive dynamics. Furthermore, it sounds so easy to just find a new fuel and there you go. But the whole infrastructure around it on a global scale, I mean, if you try and do that by yourself, it just doesn't scale, right? And then I think finally also, if you have an industry that actually stands together on a certain topic, it's quite powerful because it happens very rarely. And I think maybe later we will talk about the regulatory framework that is underway under the IMO or the International Maritime Organization. I think the reason that the industry actually stood pretty united here, putting pressure on the system, on stakeholders, I think that mattered. So that's how we see it. And my clear impression from our competitors is that they share that view and they acknowledge the problem same as we do. And I have no doubt that most of them want to be part of the solution as well.
Yeah. So you got to know when you're competing and when you're collaborating and what spaces are competitive spaces and what spaces are collaborative spaces. And you have to be able to do both with the same players. And everybody knows this. Here's where we're competing and here's where we're collaborating. It's certainly something that is special. And I think we need to see in more industries and we need to see more leadership in that respect. Let's talk a little bit about the multiple pathways and what's actually involved. And sometimes it seems when we're talking about sustainability, we need to find the solution, right? This is the source of energy, or this is the substitute, the more sustainable substitute for what we're using. Wouldn't it be easier to just focus on one solution as opposed to working simultaneously on different solutions and risking that you're spreading resources across these different solutions?
You are right that it would be nice, it would be convenient if we had just one solution and we could pick the winner at this point. But it's actually, we have made a point out of not doing that for a very specific reason. And the reason is that the reality is that there is a lot of ambiguity and there is a lot of complexity. And the world is not defined by shipping. The boundary conditions to shipping are defined by tectonic forces of how the world is developing around shipping. So the global supply chains and the global energy systems are to a large extent defining also the boundary conditions for shipping. So I think it's much more real to stay in that complexity and say, yes, it's true, we don't know exactly which fuel it's going to be at this point. So instead of pretending that we know which fuel it's going to be, let's rather work with the real ambiguity and help decision makers be in that ambiguity and that complexity. So that's really what we're doing. And I think just on an anecdotal basis, I mean, in the beginning, I spoke with people who said, oh, you know, but fusion energy is just around the corner, so we just have to wait for that radical innovation or another radical innovation, and that will completely solve the problem. And that is one way of doing it, but it's also one way of procrastinating action. I think it's much more healthy to say, okay, there is complexity out there, but there are also opportunities to get going. We know we can get going with implementing a lot of energy efficiency measures. So that's a no-regret move. Why don't we just get our act together on an industry-wide basis and start to harvest those fruits? And on the fuel side, we know that it's possible to get going on a smaller scale, step by step, like Maersk has been doing with methanol. We can find pockets of customer willingness to pay for that. We can get going with that. And those first steps on the different pathways, using methanol, using methane, soon using ammonia, using some of the bio oils, biodiesels, those small steps are going to give us a lot of learnings and will create confidence in the fact that it is possible to decarbonize shipping. So that's why we are pursuing multiple pathways with this kind of humble approach to the transition, that we are also dependent on how energy and infrastructure around shipping is developing. Shipping, exactly like Morten says, shipping can't pay the entire bill for global infrastructure on the energy side. We need to find out how those energy systems are developing and how shipping can be a part of those future energy systems.
Yeah, I think, David, it's a great question you raised there. And I think if we had been a pure trucking business or anything on land, I think it's a given what is the best technology, right? I think on land, trucks, cars will electrify. It's just a superior technology. The energy system is far more efficient. Lots of bottlenecks to be solved, but at least in our view, there's no doubt what the winning technology is. It's just a matter of scaling it and dealing with the bottlenecks as best you can. So if only that was the case in shipping, surely parts of shipping will definitely electrify. We are seeing it already with ferries and so on. But if you sail a 250,000-ton container ship from Shanghai to Bremerhaven, it's not going to happen anytime soon. And then you can either say, okay, we'll just have to sit and wait, or you can say, all right, then we got to find another solution. And as Bo explained, the reality is there is no one single magic bullet that can do this. I think our analysis, I think it's the same in the center. There's no single fuel that can do the trick for shipping. 10 years from now, we may learn that this one was better than the other one, but I think the only way to avoid the complexity that we have today would be to do nothing. And that's not really an option in our view. And I think the industry's perception also, we want to do something here and now, and then we just have to embrace this technology and deal with it. And we can.
I really like this approach so much, right? Let's not get paralyzed by the lack of the obvious superior solution. Let's be humble. Let's experiment. And I appreciated also, Bo, how you said that if it turns out that one of those pathways, one of those solutions is a dead end because you just can't mobilize the resources or because something else is superior, it wasn't a waste. You're learning something. You're developing something new. You're building capabilities in those companies to innovate and to build systems and to transition. So let's try to give listeners a little bit of a sense of what is involved. And Morten, perhaps we can take the work on methanol. So my understanding is that you don't just decide to order a couple of ships and then you call your supplier and you say, we need a few million tons of methanol. It actually requires a lot of work in order to make that happen. Can you talk about everything that is involved and how all of a sudden you guys are thinking deeply about agriculture and all kinds of other issues that perhaps previously weren't on your agenda?
Yeah, you know, when you make the brochure with your vision and your grand ideas, everything seems easy. I mean, it's just shifting the fuels. I mean, how hard can that be? Well, it can be pretty hard. And, you know, to be fair with you, in hindsight, I think we underestimated how difficult this was. Honestly, ordering the vessel was the easiest part. We had a great supplier, MAN. We paid them a visit, and you know, they accelerated that development work. And that, I don't want to in any way belittle that work, but that was probably the easiest part, if I can be honest. We then thought that once demand was there, we would be contacted by a lot of suppliers who would be eager to sell us the low-carbon molecules. And we were, but the cost points were very, very, very far from anything that could have any legs. So we've been spending a lot of time on finding the partners that can actually do this and in a way that is actually sustainable, so that it is not just sort of a low emission on paper, but actually adheres to a life cycle criteria and so on and so forth. And that has then materialized in a couple of long-term offtake agreements that we have made. That's simply necessary, because without an offtaker with a good balance sheet, you simply cannot get any debt to these new projects. But that we also succeeded with. And then this year, the first volume started arriving from our very first project, which coincidentally was here in Denmark by a company called European Energy in the southern parts of Denmark, where all of a sudden we needed to figure out, so now that they actually have produced it, how do we get it on board the vessel and bunker it and make sure that we can operate it safely and so on? So it's been quite a lot of work, I must say, but it's also been a fantastic learning journey. And I think we have been also overwhelmed by sort of how partners have leaned in and how many people and companies and organizations that actually wants to be part of this and have gone the extra mile. So municipalities, authorities, it's been quite a ride and quite a learning experience. And so you can imagine, and it was actually May this year, 2025, where this plan was inaugurated. And on that day, we actually did the full supply chain of getting the fuel from the factory to the port and did the bunkering. And our vessel, Laura Maersk, sailed on to the city of Aarhus on this electrofuel. That was a great moment, right? Because 3 years earlier, that was an idea on a piece of paper. So that's hard work, but I think anyone who has been involved in changing anything will realize that that is hard work, but also super exciting and motivating work. And I think most people who have been involved have worked hard, but I mean, the spirits have been high, and it's super meaningful work to do. So we do it happily.
I'm so glad that you put it like this, right? I think one of the reasons why I'm so optimistic, why I put so much faith in businesses' ability to drive change in this area and others, is because ultimately, you know, business is about solving problems. I like the way you described it. You know, we set the goal, we didn't quite know exactly how to get there, and then we rolled up our sleeves and figured it out, and it's been meaningful. So thank you for sharing that. And of course, while you're doing all of this, you're running a business. You said it before, you're not a charity, you're a business. And many executives I speak with say, we know we need to do more, but we also have to generate some profit, and our shareholders are only willing to support so much. How have you made these efforts sustainable in an economic sense? What has been helpful? What has been less helpful to make sure that this makes business sense for Maersk, and you can therefore continue to mobilize these resources?
This is the crux of it. I think, as Bo said, shipping really isn't hard to abate from a technical perspective. It's just expensive to abate. And that really is the problem. And we are a business. I mean, of course, we can make investments, and we have done that. We have invested in these dual fuel vessels that are more expensive and so on. We are willing to make investments, and so have many of our competitors. But you have to be a going concern. Shipping is over the cycle, low margin business. Fuel is typically 20% of your cost. And these alternative fuels are, you know, at least three times more expensive. So if you just go on and don't think about how you fund that, you simply just go out of business. And that doesn't solve any problems. So I think what has been helpful is that it's clear that for our customers, this is important. I would say 3 out of 4 of our customers, they are very curious about this. It's very important to them. Does that necessarily translate into willingness to pay? No. Not necessarily, because it is an expensive to abate sector, but it is important. So we do it for our customers and to make sure that in the future they can run their global supply chains in a way that emits less. I think that was always a very, very important driver. And we have seen from our customers a willingness to support that. We currently have a product which is mostly running on biodiesel, because that's what we can get these days. We have a little bit of methanol in there. It's around 2% of our loadings that goes on that product. And that's customers who actually pay I think Bill Gates called it the green premium, so that they actually fund the added cost of those fuels. So we do have these visionary customers and for whom this is important and who are willing to actually pay that extra. And the thing is, cost to consumer is very, very low because transportation for most goods is a very, very small part of the overall cost picture. And that has been extremely helpful in getting us going. Then, of course, technology will
help.
Can
I just stop? You said 2%. So it's 2% who have voluntarily decided to pay more for that greener...
That's where we are now. And I think we always knew that what is the roof of that? Nobody knows. Yeah. But it was important to get started because it shows that this really matters to these companies. But it's also very clear that there's no way we can get anywhere near neither our own ambitions or those of the industry or the IMO only on voluntary demand. It's simply not realistic. And shipping is unique in the sense that we are a globally regulated industry. And the thing is that regulation is very effective in passing on the cost. The cost is very small to consumer, very, very small, hardly a percent, much less than that. And regulation is actually a very effective mean to pass on the cost to the end consumer. So you and I, when we buy a pair of sneakers or whatever it is that we consume. And it's very, very positive, I think, to see how the International Maritime Organization, the IMO, have managed to actually get an agreement in place for a net zero framework. Still needs to be ratified, so it's not a done deal yet. But I do think that certainly in this geopolitical environment, which I think we can all agree is difficult, it has actually been possible for the UN to broker a global agreement for a major sector that actually can solve this problem and level the playing field financially. And when I have looked at that process, I think so many industry, academia, the center, but of course also the different national states have really leaned in. And I think it's quite an achievement that we are there. But it is also an important prerequisite to make it all the way because, yes, we have 2% now, and I don't know how high that can go, but I'm quite sure it's not going to go all the way. So regulation is absolutely key here. And we do have line of sight to that, which is quite unique.
Right. So regulation is really important. The technological advance is really important. Of course, the customer willingness and support is critical, but without regulation and innovation, you can't do this. And of course, that brings us back, Bo, to you, because again, the center is trying to set the agenda for that. Can you talk a little bit about the role that the center plays specifically with respect to regulation, getting some of these agreements in place that create that level playing field and that create the environment in which companies like Maersk and others can then rise to the challenge?
Our sector is really fortunate, you can say, to have global standards. I think after the Titanic accident, basically, it was realized that our sector needs global standards in order to regulate safety. And so the IMO has really driven very, very important regulation to keep safety levels high. Then the IMO turned to environmental issues as well and started to regulate on environment. And now lastly, it turns to climate regulation as well. And what has also happened in the IMO now with this turn to climate regulation is that it has also gone from being a very technically oriented regulator to becoming much more political. So when you talk about what is at play here in order to broker this deal, it is definitely still the technical elements, but it's certainly also some major politics coming into the game. And in the middle of that, it was a major breakthrough when IMO in April this year came to agreement that we would implement the greenhouse gas strategy. The way we have worked with this is to inform the discussions with data and analysis. And that has been very needed because there are forces for and there are forces against the transition. And something that can really limit progress in a process like this is uncertainty and the perception of risk of the transition. So just by informing the process with some deep, sound, data-based analysis of what is this going to cost, what are the implications of this, is of very large value to the whole process because it takes a lot of counter-arguments out of the debate. One of the elements in this discussion is exactly the cost of the transition, as Morten was also alluding to. Many countries and regions are concerned about additional transportation costs, and particularly developing countries are concerned that in poor countries where you can hardly feed the population and where all goods are imported, then additional transportation cost is not going to do any good to the countries. So there's been a large exercise in quantifying the impact of this transition on developing countries, just to mention one example. So just to say that there's a need to inform on the highest level about the implications, and then there's also a need to work into the details of those standards and frameworks that are going to be implemented. And so we have worked a lot into the standards of energy efficiency regulation. We've worked a lot into the standards of this new fuels coming into play. So how do you make the life cycle assessment of the climate impact of the fuels? And also, how do you make sure that the safety levels are maintained when you start to adopt fuels that are toxic, for example? So ammonia is a toxic chemical. And obviously, when you start to use that on the ships, you have to make sure that the sensor systems, that ship designs, that the crew training, all of that is in place in order to manage a new potential risk to shipping. So there's actually a lot to be contributed, both on the higher level of informing what are the implications of the transition, and certainly also down in the details of the standards.
I'm getting a sense that there's a real division of labor here between not just the two of you personally, but your respective organizations, right? Maersk, the company that accepts the responsibility, is the innovative operator, tries to show what is possible. But then the center that convenes, that explores, that shapes debates, that does independent analyses to inform decision making. Do you have a sense, could this work in other industries? I know that there are some specific aspects of shipping. You just talked about the need for global regulation. You mentioned the focus on safety that has been so central to the industry. But this sort of idea that we can have a company lead, but then have an entity such as the center convene and really work side by side in accelerating the transition. Is that something that could work elsewhere? Have you seen it work elsewhere? Are people knocking on your doors, asking you how to do this? Are you sharing some of these best practices?
We are, and we get a lot of requests for sharing the learnings from developing and operating this model to other sectors. So we've had conversations with aviation, with automotive, with steel, with cement, even with regions, some of major regions in this world, and as to how do you combine climate policy with energy policy, with industry policy, and now with defense policy. I mean, there are a number of large societal challenges where there's a good need for a good platform for industry and public sector to come together, to develop visions together, to explore pathways together, and also to collaborate on the standards and the frameworks that will be needed in order to implement this. So it's pre-competitive, and that's the headline here. It's co-creating the visions and co-creating the standards in the pre-competitive phase with the notion that once you cross the line and go into the real market and the real commercial contracts and so on, the center is not a part of that. And that line has been drawn and it has been acknowledged by all parties. And that makes it doable, you can say. That is a boundary condition that I think everybody can understand and therefore also support, you can say, a professional way of working in that pre-competitive phase. I think that's the idea. So I've been in many dialogues and also offered our support to a number of other areas that say they would benefit from this, and I would love to see it happen. I would also say, though, in all humbleness, that we have also stolen with pride from other activities, right? And put, of course, we haven't developed all of this ourselves. We have learned from joint industry projects. We have worked, learned from NGOs. We have learned from philanthropic setups in other parts of the world. And then we have combined a lot of elements into what we have here.
Let me ask you one last question. One of the other things that we hear occasionally is, yes, we know the energy transition and sustainability are so important, but what about AI and what about geopolitics and what about dealing with monetary instability and so on? And there's a sense that some of these topics perhaps have been pushed a little bit to the sidelines because other topics have become so central to the conversation in executive teams and boardrooms. What are your thoughts on this? You know, how central is the energy transition? You know, of course, it is very central at Maersk, but how do you sustain the focus on it when other important issues arise? And how can we more broadly accelerate the transition? Morten, why don't we start with you?
I think if we compare to, let's say, 3-4 years ago, I think a lot of things have happened that actually makes this more difficult. I think one thing is interest rates have gone up, right? This is CapEx, a lot of upfront CapEx. So a higher interest rate is just not helpful at all, right? I think that that's one aspect. Then, of course, also with the unrest that we see in the world these days, security of energy supply and these things and defense, and these topics have just come up the list. So there's, of course, more competition for attention here. So that has not made it any easier. But I do think that the energy transition is for real. I think any serious company acknowledges that and works on it. There may be less hype around it, so you see less headlines and less brochures and less, you know, what do I know? But there is a lot of serious work going on. And you can say 3, 4, 5 years ago, it was all about exchanging visions and competing on having the most ambitious vision. Now it's about, you know, putting steel and concrete in the ground, developing technology, deploying solutions, and it is happening. And I think also large companies, we cannot flip-flop on something as important as this, right? So I think, and that's also what we are seeing, most companies, they stay the course. They may go about it and communicate in a different way, but you stay the course because this is just, it's just a premise for doing business, right? That you have got to deal with this problem. And that's what responsible leaders do. But no, it hasn't. I mean, structurally, it has become more difficult. I think that's a fair observation.
It's a great place to leave it because, you know, it's hard, but it's important. And this is what leaders do. And the two of you are exemplary leaders in this space. We're so grateful that you've shared so many of the lessons you've already learned about how to make this happen, how to work together, how to have the vision, but then, as you said, in the end, putting steel and concrete in the ground and making it happen and remaining focused regardless of what is happening around you. Thank you so much, Bo. Thank you so much, Morten, for joining us in Leaders Unplugged.
Thanks for having us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Leaders Unplugged is a co-production of IMD and Remote Daily. This episode was produced by Frank Tabouring, Delia Fisher, Felix Seltner, and Rabia Debus. Subscribe to Leaders Unplugged on your favorite podcast platform. I'm David Bach. See you soon.